We're going to call the Senate Education Committee meeting to order. It's about 8:03 in the morning. Present are Senators Olson, Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Elton. And we want to get going here. I expect that the other members are going to show up, but we have a conflict at 9. Education Committee is going to be meeting jointly with Senate Finance. And this is a fairly big topic, so we may be just beginning today. I do want to express my appreciation to those that are here to help us begin a dialogue on what exactly More V-State means, not just for the Department of Education and for the executive branch, but for the legislative branch, and how we can work together given some of the strict timelines. I also want to just mention that we're not interested really in looking over our shoulders at what has happened in the past. We're not interested in past legal strategy or future legal strategy. And so given the time constraints this morning, if we can just kind of put those aside and do a more forward-looking thing about what our responsibilities are going to be and what the executive branch responsibilities are and what they expect from us, that I think will be a discussion that we can begin this morning. With that, I don't know if there is a preferred order of business from the executive branch side. Are we going to start, Neil, with you?
I thought I'd give a short little introduction okay. to More V-State, and then mostly we'll hear from Commissioner LeDoux and
Okay, that's great. Neil, why don't you go to the mic and identify yourself for the record. And again, we do have some time constraints. So
I'll try to be brief, although once I get started, it's sometimes difficult. Thank you, Chair Elton. My name is Neil Slotnick. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Department of Education, and I was lead counsel in the More V-State litigation. And I brought for you today just one handout of the many, many exhibits that we produce for trial. And what this is, and it'll probably take me a long time to explain it, but these are some of the statistics that we gather. This is a comparison, a year-over-year comparison since 2005 to 2008 of all the districts in the state and what percent of children in those districts are proficient in reading on what's called the standards-based assessment, our statewide assessment that we give every year. And what this shows, if the red dots, the red blocks essentially on this chart, are where that district was in 2005 and where it was in the most recent SBA given in 2008. And really what this is this is a result of the accountability system, we called it the designator system, that the legislature established back in 1998 when it told us to establish a designator system to test children, to publish those results, and to designate schools and districts as whether they're in crisis or performing adequately. And then, of course, that merged with the NCLB accountability system that came along later. And the reason that this comparison only dates back to 2005 is that you have to have tests in every single year they're comparable. You can't take a different test and compare it. So we had to focus only for this purposes of this graph at 2005, 2008. And if you look at it, you're going to see that generally,
Neil, can I interrupt for just a moment? Let the record reflect that Senator Davis has joined us. And Senator Davis, we've just begun, and Mr. Slotnick is working off this graph here.
Yeah, okay. He's better bring that stuff.
Thanks.
What you see here is that the red dots are 2005, and then the graph lines are 2008, and you see generally you see improvement all across the state. By the way, this graph tops out at 90%, not at 100%. So when you see the graphs being at the top there, that doesn't mean 100% of the kids are proficient. We can't go beyond 90% because once you can't, if you start saying that a school is 100% proficient, then you've identified individual children's records. We can't do that. But the point I'm making with this graph is that we have this is the result of the designator system, of the accountability system, working in most of these districts. Now, the issue is that in some districts, we weren't seeing sufficient progress being made. And for those districts, Commissioner Sampson made the decision in school year 2006 that he would begin a state intervention. But he had to be very careful because you don't want to intervene where the accountability system, this feedback system that we had already created for all districts, was working. You don't want the state to step in when a district is making progress on its own, because then you've got two different systems and you could possibly cause backsliding rather than help. So Commissioner Sampson worked very hard on developing what you've heard a lot about. I think it's the desk audit system, the instructional audit system, for determining what districts is it where the state can help. Doesn't necessarily mean all low-performing districts, because some of those low-performing districts are making progress on their own as a result of this accountability system that you had put in. So he had to build the system to determine which districts could help, and then he had to build what it is that the state can do once we go into a district. And his focus there, the department's focus there, was on building the capacity of the district so that it could improve on its own, making use, again, of all of this data that we now had available to it. And we presented that intervention system to you last year, the building capacity. It focused on leadership. It focused on collaboration among teachers. It focused on getting more information in the classroom using what was called formative assessments. Now, this was all going on, and the interventions were beginning, as I said, that we were building the system. The interventions began in school year 2006. There were more intervention districts added in school year 2007, and that got us up to five districts that we determined that where the state could help, and you'll see those marked here on this graph. At the same time, in 2004, the Moore case was filed.
Excuse me, Neil.
I'm sorry to stop you. But now, how do we identify where intervention has taken place?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stevens. The intervention districts are in light blue here, as opposed to dark blue. The crosshatch districts are plaintiffs in the Moore case that are not intervention districts.
And while we're on that point, Mr. Slotnick, I'm looking at the graph that you've passed out, and I'm looking at Chatham and YK school districts. And how do you make a decision on which districts to intervene in? Because both of them are at about the same percentile. YK seems to have made more progress than Chatham, yet Chatham is not a district you're intervening in. I mean, how do you make those decisions on what districts that the department does intervene?
The process is very deliberate, very involved in looking at individualized children, year-over-year growth, and where that growth is occurring, and how many schools. I actually can't answer that specific question.
Okay.
Why YK and why not Chatham? That would be a question for Mr. Morse. All I can tell you is this process is very deliberate.
For the record, they're pointing at the commissioner, I think. And so I think he has heard the question, and we can get to it later. Thanks.
So while we were building this intervention system, 2004, the Moore case was filed. And what happened there is that the plaintiffs took the same data that we show you here. And again, remember, it's the result of this designator system that we had this data available to us. The plaintiffs took this same data and they said, look at this achievement gap. This is proof that there's not enough money in education. And they took that argument to the court. And they argued that under the education clause of the state constitution, which requires the legislature to establish and maintain a system of public schools, when you have this kind of achievement gap, that's proof that you don't have a system of public schools. So the legislature isn't doing its job to establish and maintain those schools. And they argued that it was because there wasn't enough money in the system. And we've been through this ground before, and as a result of the Moore case, the original trial in the Moore case, the judge disagreed with the plaintiffs that money is the answer. And what she did after looking at the education clause is she established a four-part test for whether the legislature has complied with that clause. The first one was adequate money. There does have to be sufficient funding. She looked at the funding and the funding formula, found that those both complied with the constitutional requirements. Then she says there has to be assessments, And the third prong was there has to be standards, standards directed from the state so that districts know what the standards for education are. She looked at the standards that the Department of Education had. She looked at our assessment system that we had developed, and she found that really those were state of the art. They're some of the best in the country. She found no constitutional problems with those two elements. The fourth element that she established was that there has to be state oversight and accountability. You can't just, the legislature can delegate its responsibility for education to local political subdivisions, to local districts, but it has to oversee, it has to hold them accountable for results. And on that prong, the judge found that in most districts, we see good results. There's sufficient oversight and accountability just by virtue of having local control of education and local districts answerable to voters. But in chronically underperforming districts, she found that the state's hands-off approach to oversight of districts wasn't working well enough. And she was focusing really here, I think, on our local control statutes, which were, after all, as you remember, a result or perhaps a reaction to the system that we had in rural Alaska since statehood, from statehood up to about 1975, which was state-operated schools. And that was not a especially successful education system, the legislature decided in 1975, and went to local control. And the judge was looking at the statutes, I think, when she was looking at the fourth prong, rather than looking at the designator system that we were trying to direct her to, saying, look, we do have oversight and accountability since 1998. But looking at the statutes on the books, I think that the judge was saying, there's not a lot of authority for the Department of Education to do these kinds of interventions in any sort of hard-hitting way. And that's when, last year, we came to Senator Stevens and discussed this issue with him, discussed the strong statutory basis for local control, and he carried SB 285, which gave the department limited intervention authority, where we were able to identify that instructional practices could be improved by state intervention. Now, let me return again to the judge's finding in the Moore case. What she specifically found was that she found that she looked at these statistics and said there was evidence that in Upiat School District there was not sufficient oversight. There was evidence that that district was not focused on improving its instructional practices, that there needed to be more state involvement in that district. She instructed us to go to the legislature. She instructed the department to identify whether there were any other districts that needed to have additional state oversight, and then to report back within 1 year. So we did that. And as I explained, we already had been building that track. We had thought that this case, after all, was about money. We hadn't presented a whole lot of evidence to the judge at that point about our designator system, the accountability system, about the intervention process that we were already beginning. She'd got a smattering of it, but not the kind of detail and the kind of evidence that we thought she needed. And we went back to court this last fall, and we put on evidence about the interventions that we were conducting in five districts, about the system that we had for identification of which districts it was that we should be intervening and which ones we should leave alone because they were already making the progress on their own. And we gave her the evidence about the elements of the intervention that we'd already discussed with the legislature, the formative assessments, the leadership training, and so on. And then we gave evidence about the implementation of the interventions and on the ground what was happening. How do you move into a district from the state and actually try to make a difference? And, of course, that evidence there were aspects of the implementation that we frankly admitted didn't go all that well. There were some that went very well, and we brought that evidence to her. And then in our closing argument, we said to her that she didn't need to continue to oversee this process because it was engaged and because the legislature was engaged in it as well, that we had oversight of the intervention process from the state board, and from the legislature. There was no need, we said, for the court to continue further involvement. And what the judge decided is she agreed with us that our identification system was working. That she didn't find any fault with that system that we had for identifying which districts to go in and which ones to just stay out of, with technical assistance, but not to intervene in. She also agreed that the elements of the intervention, the leadership training, the collaborative meetings, formative assessments, that those elements that the commissioner was requiring in the intervention districts were consistent with best practices in education. She was critical of the implementation, as were we. She was maybe more critical than we would have preferred, didn't focus as much on the strong points of the implementation. She was also critical of the scope of the interventions. She felt the scope was too narrow. There were many aspects, and the commissioner will discuss some of those, where she felt we should have reached farther. But of course, that scope was expanding from even as the trial was going on, because when you go into a district for an intervention, you have to be, you can't make too many changes too quickly. And so there is no question the scope of the interventions in the first couple of years was limited. There's no question also that the scope of those interventions is expanding. And the commissioner is going to discuss that. What the court did is it told us to work with districts to amend the intervention districts, to amend the district improvement plans, to expand that scope along the lines that she saw. And one issue that I haven't brought up yet was the high school exit exam. She said that where she makes a finding of unconstitutional quality of education, which she only made for one district, which was UPIT, she said if she makes that finding, then we can't administer the high school exit exam and that we need to require remediation. There has to be remediation for those students who are taking the exam. We've required that in the last 2 years. Frankly, the evidence we had showed that districts were doing remediation and they want their kids to pass this exam. But we stepped in, we required a remediation plan, and she found the scope of that was also too narrow.
Neil, I'm looking at the clock here.
Finishing up.
Okay, and I would note that the exit exam question, probably should be a topic of discussion. I think next week we have scheduled a bill by Senator Davis about the exit exam, and we may want to discuss that bill in the context of, I suspect we may need to amend the law to kind of accommodate what the judge's ruling was on the exit exam, because if I remember correctly, she was saying you can't, if you haven't done the work that you need to do for a student, you can't apply the exit exam as a condition for graduation. And that's
another, probably a topic for another day.
And it probably should be a topic of discussion, just to be prepared for the committee when we take up Senator Davis's bill next week.
But I would like, before I close and hand it over to the commissioner, I would like to make one point, and that is that what you hear from the executives is that we're working with this decision and we're using it, and we believe that we're in compliance. And I don't want to leave the impression that we concur with the judge's legal findings. That would not be accurate to say that we think that she has drawn the line for the constitutional floor in the right place. It would not be accurate to say that we would agree with her that the evidence shows that we're not in compliance with the line, even where she's drawn it. But it doesn't mean, even though we may disagree with those legal findings, it doesn't mean that as a factual matter, we don't agree that this achievement gap that you see here needs to be addressed. And that is, in fact, what we believe has been the legislature's goal. And to the extent that the legislature's goal is in compliance or is in concurrence with what the court is requiring, we are prepared to address that. I just want to make, it's a bit of a legal hair that I need to split here just to establish for the record that we're not necessarily agreeing with her legal conclusions, but it doesn't mean we can't use this to go forward.
Senator Stevens.
Actually, I want to make sure I understand this, Neil. I understand the point that you don't concur with the judge on the issue of when she says we're not in compliance, you believe we are in compliance. You don't agree with the judge on that.
Right.
And what was the other issue that you mentioned? You're not in agreement with the judge. I couldn't quite follow that.
The other issue that I
was not. Was there another disagreement with the judge's ruling? Or is it just the issue of we believe we're in compliance, she says we are not in compliance?
Well, correct. There's first question is, through the chair, Senator Stevens. The first question is, what is the floor for education? What is the minimum that the Constitution requires? You have to draw that line somewhere. We don't necessarily would agree
right.
that she has drawn it in the right place, but even given where she's drawn it, then does the evidence show that we're in compliance? That's yet another question, and we believe that it does.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I'm going to change the order of business a little bit. We have one of the people that is on the list to talk is from out of town, and if it doesn't upset the progression of the discussion, I'd like to have John Holtz come up next. Commissioner John, we're already almost halfway through the presentation, and we have three additional people. So I guess the conclusion I'm coming to rapidly is this is the first of two overviews that we're going to have. John, if you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is John Holst. I live in Sitka, and I've been asked to take Shirley Holloway's place. She was your first choice, and unfortunately she's in Hawaii celebrating Jess's 70th birthday. Was not able to be here. So I am here partially, at least, representing Avant Garde Learning Foundation. And, of course, I need to deliver the commercial note. It's a nonprofit committed to helping communities, families, and schools to improve education for children. I'm also a contractor working with Northwest Arctic as the district improvement coach, and have been doing that for two school years. A little background: I was a principal for 13 years, taught for 8 years. I was a superintendent in two different districts in Alaska. I've been in Alaska since 1980, so I've got 29 years of history here. The last I retired as superintendent almost 8 years ago, and during that last 7 years, I have been consulting extensively, and I've worked a lot in Lower Yukon during 2001 to 2005, the last 2 years in Northwest Arctic. I have done other work in, I've done the audits, the instructional audits in Upiat and Yukon Flats, so I have some familiarity with those two districts. I've done other work in Huna, Juneau, Tanana, Nanana, and made site visits to places like Sandpoint and Aleutians and Bristol Bay, Lake and Penn, Southwest, North Slope. So I've gotten around the state, so I think I've got a fairly broad view. My entire working career was in Southeast Alaska, 10 years in Ketchikan, 3 in Craig, and the last 8 in Sitka. With that as a background, I think what you're wanting to know is what's needed, I guess. I can speak to this because I've had some experience in working recently with Shirley Holloway, Dr. Holloway, and Avant Garde, and talking about the phase two of the alignment study, which was completed last fall. And the two gaping holes in the alignment study were the pre-K and the transition from high school to the world of work and school and training. And so we were here about a week ago advocating for some funding, $22,000 to get that second phase. The most important thing, though, is I think to talk today about that pre-K piece. And I was asked to testify at the Moore case, and my name is kind of sprinkled throughout the ruling that she released a couple weeks ago. I think I was probably the person that spoke the most about the difficulty with children arriving in kindergarten at the school 2 to 3 years behind in language development. In much of rural Alaska, that is the case. It isn't universal, but in general, I think we can generalize to say that in most schools in rural Alaska, especially those that are predominantly native, students arrive at kindergarten 2 to 3 years behind in language development. And so what we expect of those teachers is for them to get the children to grow 2 years time each year in kindergarten, first and second and third grade to get caught up. These are also the same schools that have the highest turnover of teachers. The lower turnover rates are around 20% in the large rural districts. There are districts that frequently have 40 and sometimes 60% turnover. So you're expecting inside of that framework that kind of improvement. I was asked by Judge Gleason in the trial what I would do if I had the ability to change things. And what I suggested was that until we do something to intervene in that pre-kindergarten time frame and assist families. I mean, this is not a school issue alone. That is maybe one leg of a three-legged stool. The education part of it, there needs to be a parent component and working with parents. Parents are the first teachers of the children. And we all know that in homes where parents exercise that responsibility and right, those children come to school better prepared. And so finding ways of helping parents, and I believe that most parents really want to be better parents if they knew how to do that. In some cases, they just simply don't know what to do. So a parent component, a community component, some sort of support system inside that community to value the language development. Now, and when I say language development and early literacy, I personally do not believe that it matters what language it is. If it is an indigenous language of those folks living in that community, that would be all the better. The truth is, very few homes speak the languages now. The elders do, grandparents do, but most of the young adults at childbearing age do not speak their language. And so we're talking about language development. English is the predominant language for most of these children. And finding ways of developing, when children come with a limited vocabulary, and other children that you're comparing them to, as you saw on the graph recently, just a few minutes ago, you're talking about a difference of, in some cases, 2, 3, and 4 times as many words in a vocabulary. You know, 50 versus 250. And it has nothing to do with the intelligence of the students. I want to make that very clear. With the exception of those few children in some communities that have issues with fetal alcohol or something like that, disabilities, aside from that, these children are capable of learning and learning at the same pace as children in other schools. I've given you an article entitled Closing the Opportunity Gap. In fact, this was just published this week out of ASCD, so it's a very current, and when I saw it yesterday, and I routinely read articles, that's one of the reasons one of the ways I stay current, and saw this, and it was because I was preparing for my testimony today, and I saw this and thought, my goodness, this is probably a better summary than I could give. And it's written by a person who has an experience doing an intervention program with pre-K, doing literacy. And when you're talking about literacy, what we're talking about is that language development component. We're not talking about getting kids to form letters, to read and all. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is this ability to develop communication skills so that the child can communicate, can communicate both directions, can understand what's being said, and can let others know what they're thinking. And as that gets developed, the vocabulary becomes enlarged, and those children who arrive at the door, which is in Alaska, the majority of our students arrive at the school door prepared because they have opportunities.
John, Senator Olson.
As you looked at the time period of students that are now coming into school compared to, let's say, the time that TV wasn't a predominant factor out in rural Alaska, because we look at TV and TV is exclusively in English, essentially, is there not a difference between, with that exposure, are they still not ready to be in the classroom in spite of all this exposure to the English language?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think that has, it has enhanced the opportunities, but it has also become a surrogate for parenting.
Sure.
And the language development skills that you would get by interacting with somebody in speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Are there things on TV, Sesame Street, things like that are helpful? Of course. Of course they are. But they're not a substitute for the teaching that takes place or should be taking place between the parent and that child, that interaction.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Federal.
As you look at some of the issues that are dealing with childhood development, obviously out in rural Alaska, we've got a high incidence of otitis media with ear infections that are going on and hearing problems that happen, and that's an interference with language development. Do you take that into consideration as well?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I was a superintendent in two districts in Southeast Alaska, and we thought we were the otitis media capital of the world. And so this is an issue across the state of Alaska. And I'm not sure, I really don't feel like I can, I don't think that it is as big a factor as other factors like fetal alcohol syndrome and in some communities, a lack of law enforcement so that there is, there's a sense of that they aren't safe places for children or adults.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And an observation that maybe can be helpful at the next meeting, because I suspect it's a big issue. And that is, as the judge was making her decision, considering this for the last several years, I mean, was there involvement by people who deliver other services in rural communities, whether it's public safety, whether it's health, whether it's, I mean, was that part of the presentation to the court on all this? Okay, so the follow-up question that we probably need to talk about is, you know, how is the department working with other departments, to kind of address the preschool component of what is affecting K through 12, especially?
I guess you're asking what is needed, and I think there needs to be some sort of a balanced home-based program with a school program, helping parents be to carry the role of first teachers. I believe they want to do that in most cases, and just don't understand what to do. I think that the access to quality learning opportunities is important. Just having a daycare or an experience outside the home is not going to bring you any results, or very limited results. What you need to have is quality. That means professionally trained, certificated teachers directing the programs and delivering the services if possible, or if it's not possible, for instance, there's a grant right now underway in Northwest Arctic, closing the opportunity gap. Step up to learning, and this grant is focusing on all these components, the home, along with the school, but also they used Sandy Covey to do she's a real, it's Jerry Covey's wife, she's a real expert in early childhood, and this is a part of that grant, and that's the kind of high quality professional training that's necessary.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. I'd like to talk to you more about this article because I've scanned it quickly. But you know, Mark Twain's famous comment that it ends with, "I have never let my schooling interfere with my education."
It's my favorite part of the article.
I really like that. That's my experience. That's my children's experience. But that doesn't say we need more professionally trained, certificated teachers. It says that the child does it on his own. So isn't that sort of flying in the face of what you're saying?
No. I guess just to disagree with you, I think that it says exactly the same thing. That's my favorite part of the article as well. I think what we have been trying to do, and when we rely solely on a school component, if we simply say, we're going to start bringing four-year-olds into school and start teaching them how to read a year earlier, that's not what I'm saying at all. I think that you've got to have a balanced component, and we're not teaching kids how to read. An early childhood, early literacy program, a good one, focuses on language development, which is what, in most cases, these children need. And there are very specific things that can be done. What you don't want to be doing is trying to teach four-year-olds how to read. That's what I take away from the comment from Mark Twain in terms of this article. That's why it's so important to have this community and parent involvement part of this thing. And you can offer these programs a school component of them, and I think that would be a good thing to do. But that if that's all you're going to do, you're not going to have the kind of success you're looking for. I'll come back. I know you want to move on. So I think one of the problems I have seen, there are some extensive programs in rural Alaska in many places. A Head Start has been in place for many years in some of the villages. From my experience, there's been a wide range of qualities of Head Start programs. They're good people, hardworking people who mean well and in many cases do not have enough training and enough professional development to be the kind of successful purveyors of these programs as they could be. I think that's I'm trying to be delicate in how I say that because I don't want to sound critical. I think the Head Start programs have been of great assistance. I think that we are at a point now of needing to take some steps beyond that.
Thank you, John. When I hear things like that, and this is, I think, something the committee is going to have to think about. I mean, when I hear training, I mean, the question is, who does it? You know, what other programs are out there? What other service delivery people are out there? I mean, there's the Native community has some wonderful health providers that are already in the community that you know, can help families also. So it's, I think the question is, what is the role of each of these people, and for example, who does the training and who pays for it? Who gets the training?
Would you like me to make a suggestion about the money part of it?
Sure,
quickly. I'll do it really quickly, Senator. I believe that we're not at a point of saying that we need to run a pilot program. I mean, you're going to hear about a pilot program, I suspect, from the commissioner. I think we're beyond that. I mean, there have been pilot programs since the 70s, some of which were very successful. We're needing to deliver services today to these kids that are 4 years old. I'll give you a suggestion. I think that, and you can work out the legal ramifications of this, but the article talks about closing the opportunity gap. Children in Juneau, and for the most part, in many parts of Anchorage and other communities in Sitka, have opportunities. The schools that you saw on this chart that are under scrutiny do not have choices in those communities, opportunities. And you need to figure out, and it costs money to do that. And here's a simple thing that you could do, one sentence change. If you allowed districts that were under scrutiny by the department, whatever that definition turns out to be, because I suspect it's changing, that you allow those to do early entrance as 4-year-olds as kindergartners and receive funding for that. But as a trade-off, they're required to develop the kinds of early childhood interventions that I've been talking about here and to use the funds that they are then receiving, and it would be treat them like grant funds per pupil grant funds that they are then required to be responsible for providing quality literacy programs and trying to close that opportunity gap, which is what this article is about. Okay. Unless you do something to try to help those children in those districts that are at a disadvantage. So if you just simply say, we're going to start doing preschool all over the state and make it available because it's only fair, you know, I'm in a different district and I need to have funding for my constituents too. Child care and early childhood programs would be immensely popular everywhere in the state. If you're going to close the opportunity gap, you need to make it available to those who do not have it currently and don't have an opportunity to get it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Holst. Mr. Hickerson, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We've got about 17 minutes, and I guess I'm kind of looking at the commissioner here. I don't know if you heard my earlier comments about time. And I appreciate your being by the phone. Do you have any time constraints on I guess what I'm asking is how long you expect your presentation to be if we don't interrupt you with questions?
Okay. Well, as far as my presentation, what I was asked, and Mr. Holtz pretty much covered everything. I mean, he did an excellent job of my points. What I wanted to address the committee on was on effective early childhood programs, and Mr. Holtz did a wonderful job. I mean, he covered almost all my key points, and I just wanted to support the need for effective early childhood programs, and I had some comments on that. So mine shouldn't take long, and because Mr. Holtz pretty much covered everything I was going to say.
Okay, Mr. Hickerson, thank you. Can you identify yourself for the record, and then hit those points that were missed by Mr. Holtz?
Sure. This is Jim Hickerson. I'm superintendent with the Bering Strait School District in Unalakleet. Just a little quick overview. This is my 28th year with the Bering Strait School District. It's my second year as superintendent of the school district, and I've served my entire educational career, professional career, in rural Alaska. And I just want to follow up on the need for effective early childhood programs. I think Mr. Holtz covered some key points as far as how it could be implemented. The only thing I would add is for communities where there is a Head Start program or a Rural CAP program, I would support districts partnering with, because one of the things Mr. Holtz touched on is the need for training and collaboration and that type of thing. And I think if districts had the ability to work with outside agencies such as Head Start and Rural CAP or other agencies, and the districts had the ability to partner and hire professional staff, that those professional staff members would then also work with the other local providers. Now, granted, not every community has a Head Start program, so it wouldn't work as well, but for the communities that have Head Start programs or programs run by Rural CAP, I think it'd be reasonable to say one of the expectations is that you would partner with, and so you would work with the 3- and 4-year-olds. I understand the target would be more on the 4-year-olds from the school perspective, but I believe that you would have the training. I think what would happen is the local Head Start instructors would be getting training, would become better at the positions that they hold, and also I think we would stretch our dollars more by utilizing our funds together between the two groups. The other thing I want to mention as far as preschool, I know that I just want to thank the commissioner. He's been working this past week on developing what the pilot may look like and trying to get a program going. And I know he supports the needs for quality, effective early childhood programs. I do concur with Mr. Holtz. I do feel we're past the pilot stage, and I'd like to see the program implemented much quicker. But I do know from the commissioner's standpoint, he wants to make sure we have an effective quality program before we put it out across the state. But I believe we have lots of examples of quality programs, and I do know from talking to other superintendents, they are ready to implement effective early childhood programs and would like to work with the department to make that happen. The other thing to kind of follow up on a comment that Mr. Holtz made is all the different groups working together, and I think having the department sit down with law enforcement having the department sit down with the social agencies. If we're going to affect change in my district, what it's going to take is all the agencies working together from law enforcement, from social services, to meet the needs of the social and emotional needs of students. It's going to take the health consortium, health corporations. It's going to take a variety of people. As I share with my staff, we can only control the variables that happen between 8:30 and 3:30, and we need to do the best job we can during that time. But it's also all those other things that happen after 3:30 and that happen before 8:30 in the morning that have a tremendous impact on what happens in the school. And until we start addressing basically the whole child 24 hours a day, we're not going to have the, I don't believe we're not going to have the successes that I feel we need. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. And Mr. Hickerson, I mean, it would be helpful, I think, to the committee if you could kind of think through. I mean, we tend to think of, you know, what the state solutions are, so we tend to focus on Department of Education or the Department of Health and Social Services, and we often forget there are other people funded otherwise that are working in rural communities that probably have a better sense of what is happening in each individual community. So if you could, you know, put a little bit of thought into what some of those other organizations are that could be part of the solution and forward it to the committee, that would be a big help.
I'd be happy to. I've got some thoughts, and as I say, looking at the child around the, you know, around a 24-hour period, I'd be happy to forward my comments.
Okay, and then the only other comment that I have is it probably should be noted for the record that Mr. Hickerson is superintendent of a school district that is being, I don't know if this is the right word, but is being intervened with and is one of the plaintiffs in the Moore v. State suit. With that, and thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Hickerson, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I just want to say for the record, we are not one of the districts that have been intervened with. We are going to be having an instructional audit on March 2nd. But we have been working with the department, but we are not one of the intervention districts yet.
Thanks for clarifying my comments. With that, I'll begin with an apology to the department because I suspect that 10 minutes is not even going to skim the surface of what needs to be done. But why don't whoever is going to present on behalf of the department, why don't you approach the microphone? Give us a broad overview, and I suspect what we'll do is we'll try and schedule another meeting at which we can begin talking about, because I don't think we're going to have time, what the department expects of the legislature and what we need to be prepared for over the next 60 days, because it's, it's just a fact that the judge gave you 60 days and we have about 60 days left. And if there's something you require from us in that period of time, we need to establish some kind of a way to work with you quickly. But that can be, you can think about that and that can be part of the next discussion. Commissioner? If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Senator Elton. My name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development. I'm very pleased to be here. I'd have to tell you right off that many of the points made by John Holst, the department wholly agrees with. The literature is clear, and it has been for years, that success starts with early literacy programs in education. There's no disagreement there, and we look forward to moving in that direction. The Alaska Department of Education has been moving to improve the success of kids in Alaska for some time. I just left a meeting with Jim Hickerson in Anchorage where we were talking about immediate steps that we can take as a state to intervene in the graduation rate. But one of the earliest steps that we can take to improve our graduation rate is to move to a comprehensive early childhood program. And what I mean by that is to make sure that every child enters school ready to read and ready to learn with the pre-literacy skills that they need. The landscape in early education is very complex. We have a number of service providers out delivering services. Indeed, many of the schools and districts that were intervening have had early childhood programs for years that are either funded through Head Start or through impact aid provided by pass-through money from the federal government. So there's lots of providers out there to go in and immediately take over that system. may be spendy and not lead to the efficiency that we need, but clearly we need to do something. As we move in to support districts, we're moving from a philosophy of independent local control, where the department spent time monitoring and complying with, you know, ensuring compliance with federal regulations, to an arena of active participation, and in some cases, taking over certain parts of the district. This is a major change in philosophy, and the department is gearing up to move into that collaboratively. We want to move in with the minimum interference necessary to ensure that every child is successful in school, to preserve local control, and we take that responsibility. It's complicated in some ways and simple in others. Complicated because as we move through, we have to maximize community ownership so that communities own and value their schools and feel a part of their mission and the culture of that community. We have to improve instructional practices. We have to work with teachers to make sure that assessments and quality teaching are driving instruction. We have to make sure that we preserve our teachers. We need to improve teacher retention and to make sure that every teacher is a quality teacher. We know that we need to work with leadership in communities. That's administrative principals, superintendents, school boards. We need to create attitudes of success among kids. One of the most disappointing things for me as an educator is to go into a school and to see that twinkle disappear somewhere in a child, where instead of seeing what they can do, they've lost that. They worry about what they can't, and they don't believe in themselves. But if there is one key right now in the long term, and that's to make sure that every child comes to school ready to read, and the department is moving in that direction. Our pilot program is designed to be implemented throughout the state. It's designed to ensure that a good component of it is to increase the capacity of parents to work with their own children. I certainly agree that the school can't do everything, but we can do more to help parents have the skills necessary to help their children read. And I have to tell you, this is not a problem reserved for rural Alaska. I've been a principal for 10 years at the elementary level, and as our community worked together to decide what we needed to do to be successful, we quickly identified that many of our young people came to school without any early learning experience, and that if we were going to move forward to achieve our goals, we had to find a way to work with those parents to facilitate those activities and learning experiences. With regard to partnerships, one of the things that the department has recognized early this year is that we have to work together. So we've established a close partnership with the university. When we testify before you, we'll probably come together with the Department of Labor, the University of Alaska, Health and Social Services. We are working closely because we know that we need to work together with regard to the health and safety of our children. So we meet regularly. I would also like to say that many of the interventions that we've implemented this year were not considered by the judge. And I've learned in talking to committees to try to keep things brief. And so I have several pages of implementation steps that we've carried out this year that I will not go over with you today in detail. But Les Moore is here, the deputy commissioner, is here to talk about some of these. But these were not considered in the latest decision by the judge. In reference to Senator Elton's question, what you can do for us as a legislature right now is to consider carefully our request for a pilot program so that we can study and learn to make sure that when we expand this program, it will be efficient and will actually meet the needs of children. We can't afford to waste resources without careful thought. We had a meeting in Anchorage this week where the service providers from across the state came together to develop a strategy to do an effective implementation. We think it's critical, given the financial climate, to do it effectively. We also hope that you will support the request for increased Head Start funding so that we can target those resources to communities that need a slot here or a slot here, or communities that do not have a program due to lack of funding. We support that request. We also recognize that the department has to move from a stance of providing compliance and monitoring to one of active technical support. So we have an increase or an increment in our budget of over $800,000 so that we can contract for technical support to districts and everything from the arts to technology to reading. We've been advertising for a reading specialist this year. We need one right in the department to facilitate programs in schools. So that's the immediate thing that the legislature can do to support those increments. I will tell you, we'll be back again to request money for increased funding for early learning. We'll be back to request increased money for technical support. This is just the first step, but our stance is we want to do it well. And I think in a future hearing, when Deputy Commissioner Morris, who's been tasked specifically to lead the school improvement effort, when he has a chance to share with you some of the things that we are doing with current resources, I think you'll know that we're working to use funds efficiently and directly. More money is not always the solution, and just training will not do it. Our success in Alaska is multidimensional, and we intend to pursue it that way.
Thank you. I'll note there are 2 minutes left. I'm going to use 20 seconds of them. It would be helpful. You noted that you have a list of things the department is doing. I think before the next meeting, if it's in an easily shareable format, it might be helpful and speed things up if you provide that before we have a conversation with Mr. Morris, because that helps prepare us a little bit. And the other question that I would have that we can address at some point later is, I'm not hearing maybe all that I want to hear when we talk about partnerships. I mean, I guess my initial reaction is partnerships need to expand beyond just state agencies and expand to people that are already providing services in rural communities that are not state agencies, but are health consortiums, other entities that can provide, you know, help to families, and how and if it is a good idea for the department to begin reaching out to them also, not just Health and Social Services and not just Department of Labor. And then and that can be answered at the future meeting. Senator Stevens.
Well, I know we just have a minute, but I also want to say that I would hope in the future to hear more. But I've observed Commissioner Liu through all the steps of his career, and really respect him. And the issue that I think is truly troublesome to me is local control versus the state stepping in and taking over. That's such a touchy issue, and I'd appreciate hearing how we're going to deal with that, how we're going to work our way through that.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens.
And I know you can't answer it now. Yeah.
We recognize.
In fact, you don't have time to answer it now, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I just want to echo. I'm sitting here listening to this, and I'm thinking to myself, you either have to be a saint or foolish to step into the job that you have stepped into recently, given the challenges that are in front of you. With that, we're going to recess. Should have done that. Said this before I hit the gavel. Ignore the gavel. We're going to recess and reconvene in Senate Finance for the joint presentation on seismic hazards. With that, we're in recess. Thank you very much.